Do you love the outdoors? Do you wish that you had a way to keep it with you all throughout the week? Well, Atomic Child is an artist-run brand that is inspired by nature. They capture the great outdoors through their unique designs. Their designs can be found on a number of products on their website, including stickers, blankets, water bottles, mugs, pins, patches, and more. My personal favourite is their Bigfoot design, as well as the Vintage Mountain design. So head on over to atomicchild.com, that is atomicchild.com, to browse their products and bring nature to you. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join me weekly as I uncover some of the world's most heinous murders. Bargo is located just off the Hume Highway in the New South Wales Southern Highlands in Australia. It's a sleepy little town known most for its interesting bushranging history. It's also known as the gateway to Picton Lakes, the very last pristine freshwater lake near Sydney. However, in 1992, a 9-year-old girl vanished on her way home from school, and in the aftermath, the small town of Bargo was left forever marred by the tragedy. Ebony Simpson was a 9-year-old girl living in Bargo, New South Wales, Australia, with her parents, Peter and Christine, and her two older brothers, 15-year-old Zach and 14-year-old Taz. She was a Year 4 student at Bargo Primary School. According to those who knew her, she was a timid young girl, but was always happy and easygoing. To her friends and family, she was affectionately dubbed Bonnie. Ebony loved playing netball, and she dreamed of being a police officer when she grew up, and it was a goal that nobody ever doubted Ebony could reach. As her next-door neighbour and friend, 12-year-old Dean Melman said, she was talented at everything she did. Next, we will hear from Christine.
We'd bought an old farmhouse and done that up. We'd been there about 14 years. We'd chosen to live in the country, and the boys at a country school, and then Ebony came along. So it was an ideal life for children and us. She was soft, kind, and we were very close. She was just lovely and warm. It was just really nice, you know, a nice way to live.
According to Christine, Ebony loved looking cool, listening to Daryl Braithwaite songs and playing in the swimming pool with her friends from school. Ebony would often be driven to and from school, but on occasions where her parents were too busy, she would get off the school bus, which dropped her off around 400 metres from her home. When she did get the school bus, either one of her brothers or one of her parents would meet her at the bus stop and walk her home. However, on the 19th of August, 1992, Peter and Christine had been visiting relatives in another town. At around 4 p.m, Ebony climbed off the school bus at the corner of Bargo and Arena Roads. Zach had been planning on meeting Ebony once she got off the school bus. However, Zach's bus was late, so Ebony climbed off the school bus and started to walk in the direction of her home alone. She was the only child to step off the school bus at that particular stop. She was spotted by one of her neighbours, Nellie Abella, as she walked in the direction of her home. However, Ebony never made it home. Later on that afternoon, when Zach got home from school, he was perplexed to see that Ebony wasn't at home. Shortly thereafter, Christine called the home and Zach informed her that Ebony had not yet arrived from school. Zach immediately started calling around Ebony's friends. Maybe she had gone to a friend's house after school or stopped by the mall. However, none of Ebony's friends had seen her and informed Zach that Ebony did get off the school bus. Christine rushed home. I arrived home a little later, pulled into the drive, and I couldn't see Ebony's shoes. I had this horrible feeling, and I just knew, she recollected.
She went to school, she didn't come home. And she got off the school bus. And, she had to walk a couple hundred yards just up the road. And she just didn't come home.
Christine searched around the neighbourhood and took the route that Ebony would have taken from the bus stop. However, Ebony was nowhere to be found. Christine rushed back home and called police to report Ebony missing. Detective Sergeant Rod Grant was one of the first officers on the scene and he launched a major police search. Police from both Camden and Picton were assisted by the dog squad as well as local SES volunteers. As they combed through the area, a police helicopter hovered overhead. Missing person flyers were distributed. They described Ebony as standing at around 130 centimetres with waist-length fair hair. She was wearing a blue tracksuit and a pink parka coat and was carrying a pink bag when she was last seen. All neighbours were asked to report if they had seen anything suspicious that day or anything that was out of the ordinary, no matter how insignificant it may have seemed at the time.
An older man come up to the command post. He'd heard that there was something wrong and there were a lot of police cars, so he come up to ask what was happening. And he told the General Duties Police that his two sons had seen Ebony walking home and just before she got around the corner just near her house, there was a small yellow car with a man with the bonnet up. And the boys waved to her, to Ebony, and she waved back to them and they continued driving home.
One neighbour informed police of a man around 18 or 19 years old who was seen tinkering under the bonnet of a dirty white or yellow coloured car, possibly an early model Mazda or Datsun in Arena Road. The man was just ahead of Ebony as she was about to turn the corner and begin walking on Arena Road. The initial search for Ebony turned up no clues, so the following day a massive search was arranged. It would be one of the largest police searches in New South Wales in recent years. Over 200 police officers, emergency services staff and volunteers would be conducting a house-to-house search in Bargu and Picton districts. Tracker dogs, trail bike riders and police divers searched a 5 square kilometre area in the semi-rural surrounds, including a number of creeks and waterways. However, there was no sign of Ebony. By this point, police had acknowledged that Ebony had most likely been kidnapped.
I don't know when you let a child get off a school bus. We'd lived there for 14 years. People said, let her get off the bus. All kids should be allowed to do that and just walk around up the corner and home. It's a part of growing up, but, obviously I'm wrong. I think you make anything up in your head that gets you through that time, but I don't think we slept. We just stood there waiting for some sort of answer. They said, she would have gone to someone else's place to play, but she wouldn't do that. She wasn't like that, you know what I mean?
Police additionally announced that the car the neighbourhood spotted had been seen several times in the area during the past week. It was described as being in poor condition with stains from a smoky exhaust pipe. Police gave a description of the man. He was wearing a black long-sleeve top and black jeans. He stood at around 177 centimetres and had straight, brown, shoulder-length hair and was of thin build. According to police, a similar car had been seen several times around primary schools and high schools in the surrounding area over the past few months. However, police said it can't be discounted, but whether it's the same car is another question. In fact, Christine would say that just days before Ebony's disappearance, she too had seen the man with the yellow car. Strangely enough, he was at the side of the road, tending to his car, near the bus stop.
I thought he was just some young guy and, you know, his car had broken down. And I went down to get Ebony off the bus and went past him, and I remember looking at him and thinking, I'll pick Ebony up and I'll come back around and I'll see if I can help you.
Ebony's disappearance shattered the tight-knit community in the Southern Highlands, especially parents. In the immediate aftermath, it was rare to see a child walking home from school or even see a child on the school bus. Most parents were so shaken up by Ebony's disappearance that they opted to take their children to school and pick them up themselves. The Sydney Morning Herald spoke with one parent, Denise Zelotis, who said that she was keeping her children home, one of whom was Ebony's classmate. "We're in shock. To tell my daughter that someone has possibly hurt her friend, she can't understand it," she said.
At that time, there's two tasks, and we had to separate that pretty early on. There's a search for Ebony, and there's also a criminal investigation, both taking place at the same time. So the search was set up as a grid pattern for several kilometres around where she was last seen. Homes and paddocks, dams, you know, bush.
Unfortunately, the day-long mass search proved fruitless. However, just the following day, a grim discovery was made in a dam just 6 kilometres away from Ebony's home.
We walked up to the dam, and it's something that sticks with me forever, and I get goosebumps talking about it, is walking up over the top of the lip of the dam and seeing the pink lunchbox floating on the water. And the water was like as still, no wind, no movement at all. It was just like glass.
Submerged in the water, they find the lifeless body of Ebony. It would soon be revealed that Ebony's killer had directed police to the scene. The man was identified as 29-year-old unemployed father of two, Andrew Peter Garforth, the man who had been spotted tinkering under his car bonnet near the school bus. While the search for Ebony had been underway, Christine had helped compose an e-fit of the man she had seen with the yellow car just days before Ebony's disappearance. In an amazing twist of fate, as the sketch was being composed, a number of officers spotted Andrew in his yellow Datsun. Without jumping to conclusions, they spoke to Andrew, and later that day, they were shown the e-fit and recognised it straight away as Andrew.
We couldn't do anything more with what we had, with what she'd provided me. I walked outside, and as I was walking up to the front gate of the property, my boss came down, and I just said, "Well, this is what Christine Simpson's given me," and he took a step back and he said, "That's the bloke we were just talking to."
When Andrew was brought in for questioning, he confessed to abducting Ebony and murdering her.
Went to the hardware shop, bought 2 bolts.
What time was it when you left to Garage Bargo to the video store?
Yeah, 3:45. When I drove down Pheasant's Nest Road, turned left onto Nightingale, and left onto Arena, right onto Bargo.
How long does it take you to drive from your home at Pheasant's Nest to the video store at Bargo?
Roughly 10 minutes. I had the bonnet of the car up, I had the boot of the car open, and when the young girl was walking past the car, I grabbed her in the boot. I drove away.
And where did you drive to?
Down Arena.
And what did she say to you?
She asked me if I was going to let her go, and I said I didn't know.
Andrew's criminal record dated back to his youth, but there was nothing in his history to indicate that he was capable of such a heinous murder. He had offences of dishonesty, breaking, entering and stealing, traffic matters and one drug matter. In fact, Andrew had been charged with 76 crimes over the years and had been convicted on 41. He had been living in the area for just 5 weeks after skipping bail in Western Australia. His family had relocated from Western Australia to Picton and then on to Bargo, and he had lived just 3 kilometres away from Ebony's home. Andrew was subsequently taken to Picton Courthouse to be charged with the murder of Ebony. A crowd of around 200 assembled outside of the courthouse and shouted abuse and pelted rocks and eggs at Andrew as he was bundled into the courthouse. A police cordon had attempted to keep the angry crowd at bay, but to no avail. Emotions were running extremely high, and as one member of the crowd said, "My daughter went to school with that little girl and she didn't deserve to die like that."
Keep looking over your shoulder, buddy.
Yelling abuse at Garforth.
"Well, tie his arms and legs and see how he goes. Come on, get him in now.
You know, you filthy so-and-so, you die, you pig, and, you know, hang him," and all this sort of stuff. It was real lynch mob stuff. And I really, you couldn't blame them. It was the community venting.
The courtroom was packed with Ebony's family and other locals. They erupted with angry shouts as the judge revealed that Ebony had been abducted by Andrew, raped, and then thrown into the dam while still alive. Andrew stared to the floor as Sergeant Andrew Sutton outlined the allegations. He described how Ebony was walking towards her home when she approached Andrew, who was standing beside his Mazda 808 sedan with the boot open and the bonnet up. As Ebony walked past Andrew, he grabbed her from behind and shoved her into the boot. Next, Andrew drove Ebony off to a dirt track in Charles Point Road. Once here, he took Ebony out of the boot and placed her in the front seat, during which she pleaded for her life and begged to be let go home. Tragically, Ebony's pleas fell on deaf ears. Andrew then took Ebony from the car to the edge of the nearby dam.
"I took her up onto the bank of the dam, tied her hands and her feet, pulled her pants down around her ankles, sexually assaulted her, picked her up, and threw her in the dam."
Here, he bound her hands behind her back and bound her feet with wire. Andrew then raped Ebony. Once finished, Andrew threw Ebony, who was still bound, into the dam. He then stuffed her backpack with rocks and threw it in after her, attempting to conceal any evidence that Ebony was ever at the dam. As Ebony struggled to stay afloat in the dam, screaming and crying for help, Andrew left the scene. Ebony, who was an accomplished swimmer, had no chance of reaching the bank. When Andrew left the dam, he knew all too well that Ebony was going to drown. According to Sergeant Sutton, Andrew later came back to the area where he had kidnapped Ebony and voluntarily joined the other local people in the search for her. By this point, there wasn't a dry eye in the courtroom. The magistrate, Mr. Ian McCrae, urged the courtroom to keep their composure and cautioned them that until the due process of the law were completed, no presumption of guilt could be drawn. He subsequently denied bail and remanded Andrew in custody to appear in Borwell Court on the 12th of October to face committal proceedings. The crime devastated the entire community, including Andrew's common law wife, Denise, with whom he had two sons, aged 1 and 3. At the time of Andrew's arrest, he and Denise had been planning on having a third child. Denise told a Channel 9 reporter from a current affair that she still loved Andrew, despite the fact that she felt hurt and destroyed by what he had done, adding that he had always been an amazing father to their children, and she couldn't quite comprehend what had happened. Just days later, Andrew was transferred from Long Bay Jail after sustaining two attacks by other inmates. The first attack came as he was sitting alone in a locked holding yard, and the second attack came when a group of inmates managed to break in to his locked cell. He was subsequently transferred to Goulburn Jail, where he was placed under protection. On the 27th of August, Ebony was laid to rest.
The image that will stay with me for life, apart from the facts of the story, but the image that will stay with me for life is seeing that little coffin. As adults, you go to funerals, you say goodbye to your loved ones, but this wasn't an adult coffin, it was a child's coffin, and that was someone saying goodbye to their child. There's a little girl who was so brutally murdered and didn't deserve it, and the community was saying goodbye to her.
Hundreds of mourners gathered into the St. John's Anglican Church in Camden, southwest Sydney, to pay their final respects to the innocent girl who had captured the country's attention. the mother of murder victim Janine Balding, whose case I covered in episode 21 of Morbidology, joined the mourners at the funeral service. There wasn't a dry eye in the church as Mr. Barry Edwards, a friend of the family, read out a moving eulogy. Ebony Simpson was a beautiful example of all that is good in human beings. She embodied qualities which every one of us admired, he said. Barry also spoke on behalf of Ebony's parents. We learned so much from her. It was as though she was an angel, only on loan to us to help us through a period in our lives when we needed her as an example. Bonnie gave pure joy to everyone that knew her. To us, she was pure perfection. Goodbye, dear little Bonnie. Goodbye, sweet little angel, he said. Reverend Neil Mayhew questioned why something like this had happened and described how life is a mixture of good and evil. Ebony's classmates, many of whom were crying, formed a guard of honour around Ebony's tiny white coffin as it was carried from the church. Shop workers and shoppers lined the streets as the funeral procession made its way through the town towards the cemetery at Thirlmere. Peter and Christine clutched their son's hands as the dainty white coffin, adorned with pink and white flowers, was slowly lowered into the ground. The police officers who had worked on the case saluted the coffin, while Ebony and Ivory, a song by Paul McCartney and Stevie Wonder, emanated from a loudspeaker. Hero Cosmetics are one of today's sponsors, and they sent me over the Mighty Patch, which is an acne patch that gently pulls out pimple gunk and helps the blemish heal faster. Over the years, I've used a lot of harsh acne and skin products that have ended up irritating my sensitive skin. Furthermore, none of them ever really work at eliminating spots, so I was dead excited to try this product. Being cooped up at home, my skin has suffered, so before I went to bed, I placed the Mighty Patch on a spot and peeled it off in the morning. It's a little bit gross, but it's also satisfying to see the gunk that is absorbed on the patch. It literally made my spot vanish overnight, which is completely insane to me. No longer will I have to panic about a massive spot when I have important places to be. If you'd like to try the Mighty Patch for yourself, use code MORBIDOLOGY15 on Hero Cosmetics to save 15% on your first purchase and see the magic for yourself. Payoff.com is the paying sponsor of this episode of Morbidology. You've tried balance transfers and budgeting, but high interest rates and unrelenting bill cycles make it almost impossible to get out of credit card debt on your own. Instead of another new savings technique, you need a clear path out of debt. And that's what a payoff loan can do. A payoff loan is a personal loan backed by member-centric credit unions designed to help you pay off your credit cards. With rates as low as 5.99% APR and loan amounts up to $35,000 with no hidden fees and personal customer service support from Payoff to help you reach your financial goals. Some of the benefits of a payoff loan may also include potential credit score boost, one monthly payment, and savings from lower interest rates. Go to payoff.com/morbidology to learn more. Checking loan rates won't affect your credit score. Try something new. Pay off your credit card debt with Payoff. NMLS ID 1396805. Not all applicants may qualify. Loans only available within the United States. Loan is not available in all states. Payoff works with lending partners who originate the loans. Additional terms, conditions, and eligibility requirements may apply. More information is available at payoff.com/morbidology. In February of 1992, Andrew was back in court, where it was revealed that following his arrest, he had told investigators that he didn't plan on abducting Ebony. During the interview, he repeatedly said that he didn't know what he intended on doing with Ebony or why he had even grabbed her in the first place. During the committal hearing, Christine shouted out, "How could you take my daughter like that? How could you?" During the court hearing, more information about the day of the abduction was publicised. Earlier on that day, Andrew had been shopping in Campbelltown with his wife and two sons. Following lunch, he went to the Bargo video shop and to Tamore, where he purchased some bolts from a hardware shop. He then stopped on Bargo Road, allegedly to put oil in his car. It was while doing this that Andrew spotted Ebony walking towards him. He ordered Ebony to keep quiet and turned his radio up really loud to drown out any sound Ebony made from inside the booth. Once at the dam, he placed Ebony on the front passenger seat where they chatted for around 15 minutes. During the interview with police, Andrew said, "She asked me if I was going to let her go and I said I don't know." He described how he next bound her, sexually assaulted her, and then threw her into the dam. The investigator asked Andrew what Ebony did, and he replied that she shouted for help. According to Andrew, Ebony was on her back in the water and was struggling to make her way to the bank. He was then asked what he did, and he simply replied, "I walked away." Andrew showed no emotion during the court hearing, as Mr. Ian McRae committed him to stand trial on the murder charge. Then in July, Andrew appeared in court once again, but this time he was there to plead guilty to the murder of Ebony. Mr. Justice Newman did not admit into evidence a number of victim impact statements from the Simpson family, stating, "Plainly enough, the effects of these events upon the victim's family would be horrific." He described how Ebony's last moments on Earth must have been filled with terror. Andrew offered no defence for his crimes or an explanation. Again, as I noted earlier, his callous and casual comment as to what he would have expected to happen to his victim as she struggled in the water is chilling to the extreme, said Justice Newman. Andrew was subsequently sentenced to life in prison. As the sentence was read out, the packed courtroom erupted with cheers and claps. According to Mr. Justice Newman, Andrew's attitude to the crime was reflected by his interviews with investigators, during which he confessed to what he had done to Ebony in an extremely cool and casual manner. Andrew was only the fifth person in New South Wales history to ever receive a life term, which meant that he would never be released. The following year, Andrew asked the Supreme Court to reduce his life sentence, claiming that the murder was not in the worst case category. His counsel, Mr. Martin Sides, QC, argued in the Court of Criminal Appeal that the crime did not fall into the class of crime for which the life sentence was intended when it was introduced. In all of the circumstances of this case, when one approaches it in a correct fashion, this does not fall into that category of the very worst or the most heinous, said his counsel. This, of course, was pretty ridiculous. I personally cannot think of many crimes that could be worse than abducting a child, sexually assaulting her, and then throwing her into a dam to drown on her own. According to Andrew and his counsel, the judge failed to give due consideration to several mitigating factors, which included Andrew's guilty plea and his admission to police. Ultimately, his appeal failed. Several months later, Andrew appealed against his life sentence once again. Christine spoke to the Sun Herald and said that she and the rest of the family were distressed that Andrew was appealing once again. "How many judges do you need to say someone's guilty? We've had four judges already saying it, and now there will be another three. It makes a nonsense of the truth in sentencing legislation," she said.
"This man's raped and murdered my daughter. He's a pedophile. The legal system will step in and everything." No, it doesn't. I believed he'd just get locked up for life, but it's not like that. I said, "That's not acceptable." I said, "You can bring back the death penalty, lock him up for the term of his natural life, or I'll get a hitman and blow him away." And, you know, I wasn't joking back then, and I'm still not joking today.
Once again, however, the High Court rejected the application by Andrew. Following the decision, Ebony's family made a statement in a crowded conference room in the headquarters of the New South Wales Police Service in Redfern. Peter spoke in a calm tone as he described how losing Ebony in such a violent way felt like somebody had cleavered him in half. He said the images of what Andrew did to his daughter play over and over again in his head, like a video on repeat. I can't believe it happened to us. One day, we had a family, a life on a lovely farm, and now our only daughter has been murdered, he said. The Simpson family were there as part of the homicide victim support group, who had arranged a conference with police officers attending a workshop on the needs of murder victims' families. The family members of the group had all had ordinary bereavement counselling services, but of course, they're set up to cope with death, not murder. In the wake of a child's murder, nobody really knows what to say. Like anybody grieving, these family members need to be able to talk about what they're going through or how they feel, or it's impossible to move forward in their lives. In the wake of Ebony's murder, Peter reached out to the Institute of Forensic Medicine's counselling section, and the following day he heard back. John Merrick, who was head of counselling at the Institute, put Peter in contact with Gary and Grace Lynch, the parents of Anita Colby, who was murdered in 1986. It was the murder of Anita Colby that truly destroyed Australia's image as a place where senseless murders rarely occurred.
So he introduced us to Anita Cobby's parents, Gary and Peg Lynch, and John and four other social workers from Glebe, Coroner's Court, and we got together, and that's how the Homicide Victim Support Group was started.
It was from this meeting between the Simpsons and the Lynches that the Homicide Victim Support Group was created. It started with just 9 members, but within 15 months, that swelled to over 120. According to Martha Jabor, the executive director, the purpose of the group was to provide support and introduce newly bereaved families to people who know exactly what they're going through, the parents who had lost their children to murder. The other purpose of the group was to educate others, starting with the police, who are the family's first point of contact and source of information when a child is murdered. During the police workshop, both Peter and Christine expressed regret that they did not identify Ebony's body. Quite often, parents are advised against viewing their child's body, but ultimately, the decision should be up to the parent. Some feel as though they need that closure so that they can truly move forward. The last memory I have is dropping my dear daughter off at school. I probably needed to see how she ended up, said Peter. According to Gary, Anita's father, parents of murdered children cannot be hurt anymore. So don't pull your punches and let us have it, he said. According to the Homicide Victim Support Group, far too often police are reluctant to share any graphic details about how their child died. And during the workshop, Peter, Christine and the other parents informed police that this is the wrong way to go about it. They would rather hear the details from the police as opposed to reading it in a newspaper or hearing it on the radio. Speaking of an article in Who Weekly about Ebony's murder, Peter said, "The media infringes on my life anyway. Everything in that article was true. I don't want people to forget Ebony's death. I don't want people to forget how she died. They are horrific crimes that should never have happened in this country. I have a responsibility to educate the public about what happened." All of the parents in attendance agreed that the judicial system was a far greater setback than the media. The media is open about crimes and victims, while police tended to tiptoe around the facts so as to not deepen scars. Peter also took a minute during the workshop to thank the officer who took him to the dam where his daughter lost her life. He said that the officer stood nearby as he screamed into the sky. Those left behind need that extra bit of care. That's what we're trying to achieve with the education program, he said. The father of 18-year-old Michael Marsloo, who was shot dead during a robbery, made a very poignant remark during the workshop. I am not going to let Michael's life become a statistic, be a waste. He was a real human being. That's why I'm keeping Michael's memory alive, to make society a better place. The pain will never go. You just learn to live around it, he said. Shortly after the workshop, the Homicide Victim Support Group received $20,000 from the New South Wales government to help set up a recovery centre. In September of 1995, Andrew lodged a claim with the Victims Compensation Tribunal for assault he suffered from the other inmates in Long Bay Jail and Goulburn Jail. The government subsequently conceded that Andrew could claim up to $50,000 compensation for the attacks. Peter said that the fact that Andrew even had the ability to make such a claim showed that society had lost the plot. While Andrew was entitled to claim for compensation, laws allowed for any money awarded to him to be transferred to Peter and Christine if their claim for victims' compensation was successful, and the couple certainly had a strong claim for compensation. Ultimately, Andrew's claim was denied due to the harsh backlash from locals. In October the following year, a move was put forward for the Victims' Compensation Bill to remove the rights of convicted prisoners seeking compensation from the Victims' Compensation Tribunal from injuries resulting from crimes of violence. The catalyst for this change was Andrew claiming compensation for being attacked in prison. Since the Compensation Bill was introduced in 1987, nearly 100 prisoners had been paid a total of $2 million. Then the following month, the government instead said that they would support inmates' rights to compensation in special circumstances. An opposition strongly rejected the move, stating that prisoners were staging their own beatings to receive compensation, and suggested that inmates forfeited their right to make such a claim when they committed a crime. In February of 1997, the Homicide Victim Support Group received $200,000 from the New South Wales government for 24-hour phone support and grief counselling for the families of murder victims. By this point, more than 300 families were now members. The additional funding meant that the group could employ a full-time grief counsellor and provide 24-hour support. By this point, the group had already established similar organisations for family members of murder victims in Queensland, South Australia and Western Australia. Furthermore, a group in New Zealand was also being established. Christine praised the government for the decision. "For once, we've got a government that actually looks after people who are left behind after murder. The true victims, the living victims of crime. All the previous governments have always looked after the murderers and their well-being. That is why this grant is a great achievement," she said. The same year, Peter and Christine's marriage fell apart, but for a while they still showed a unified front and continued with their work for the Homicide Victim Support Group. In addition to their advocacy with the group, they helped establish Ebony House, a refuge in Illawarra for murder victims' families. It contained 24 beds and was Australia's first such refuge. Over the years, it would be used to hold Christmas parties for children who had lost family members to murder.
Well, I think I took all my anger and turned it into something positive and set up Ebony House, first recovery centre in the world for homicide victims. So I burnt up all my angry energy into positive, you know, and I didn't know what else to do with it. Made a lot of changes and very powerful back then.
In the wake of Ebony's murder and Andrew's life sentence being handed down, many in Australia called for capital punishment to be reinstated. In February of 1998, Christine wrote a letter to the Illawarra Mercury and broke her silence on her views of capital punishment. It read in part, "Until now, I have been silent on my views about the reintroduction of the death penalty. However, I feel now it is time to give the community a perspective of what my life has been like since my daughter's murder. I have worked desperately hard to rehabilitate myself and to ensure that my life is a positive example to my two sons and the community. In order to do this, I have tried to repair my life by going to work, paying my taxes, and endeavouring to live a normal life in abnormal circumstances. Some days, though, this is a struggle. The burden of my grief is increased with the knowledge that part of my tax dollar houses, feeds and educates the murderer of my daughter. This man lives in prison supported by the people of New South Wales without all of the day-to-day responsibilities I must face in my life. I must also live with the knowledge that Andrew Garforth still has the right to be paid a wage in prison and to have visits with his children. He will be permitted to see them grow into adulthood. He has taken this right from me. I will never see Ebony become a woman and marry. I will never see the grandchildren she would have given me. Some may say that a humane society should not take the life of a convicted murderer under any circumstances. I, because of my experience, must reject this point of view. As Ebony's mother, my life has been changed forever by Garforth's act. I had no choice in the matter, and yet I must live each day with the consequences. While Christine's letter to the newspaper changed the stance of many readers, it did nothing to change the law. Australia remains one of the countries that does not have capital punishment. In 2015, Andrew was back in the media after he was reclassified from an A2 prisoner to a B prisoner, meaning that he was eligible to apply for work and rehabilitation courses. The announcement came as a shock, not only to Ebony's family, but to the entire country. The crime was such a brutal and vicious crime, and Andrew had never shown any remorse for his actions. Many feared that other notorious killers could follow suit. The reclassification was made on the advice of the Serious Offenders Review Council, whose job it is to manage serious offenders. He came onto our property. He joined the search. We fed him. He's a horrible man. Why do you think he needs to be doing a course? Questioned Christine.
He joined the search party. I mean, when I think of that today, it makes me nearly sick. You know, we were looking after the person who knew where she was and had already killed her.
How callous can you be to murder a little girl like that and then pretend to search for her? Obviously, it's come out now or suggested that his Garforth's wife convinced him to join the search party, do the right thing, do the community thing. And, you know, he's masqueraded as a searcher for his own victim. That's just unbelievably callous.
In less than 24 hours, a change.org petition against the decision reached over 35,000 signatures. Following the backlash, New South Wales Minister David Elliott intervened and ordered the council to reverse their decision. He subsequently vowed that Andrew would die in prison and would never be reclassified as a B prisoner. Ebony's brothers have gone on to marry and have children of their own, something that was denied to Ebony. Both Christine and Peter are overjoyed that two of their children got the opportunity to develop into adults and lead lives of their own. There are many moments when sadness washes over me. It happens at all times, say when I see a young woman around the age Ebony would be today, and I wonder what she would be like. Sadness will be with me for life, but I'm comfortable with that because it's my link with my daughter, said Christine.
We changed a lot of things and that was good. But as I've got older, 20 odd years down the track, I have to say the pain's still the same. I'm happy with what's been done, but I've learned to put it somewhere, and I have built a nice life. No matter what you do in your life, and I've put my life back together, I think, pretty well. But there's a part of my heart that's broken, and I can't fix it. It doesn't matter how many years go by or how much I talk about it, I can't fix it. And I'm angry about it, you know? I'm angry about what happened to my daughter. I don't want to have people tell me that I shouldn't be angry. I damn well should be angry. A man took my daughter's life and ruined our family. I'm angry, all right, you know. And it's just this stupid system we got out there that says you're supposed to forgive and not be angry. I find it absurd, you know. I mean, if I wasn't angry and upset, I wouldn't be a mother, would I? Put Ebony behind you and move on with the life. No, I'll take her with me and move on with the life. I have no forgiveness whatsoever for what that man did to her. And you can move on. You don't have to forgive to move on. I can see Ebony as plain as anything. She's still nine. I can see her hair. I can see everything about her. I can hear her voice. And no, I can't forgive a person who took that away from our family.
Far too often, family members of murder victims are ignored or forgotten about by the government in the aftermath of the crime. However, in the wake of the murder of Ebony Simpson, it was imperative that something needed to be done. The government's keen to make sure that they recognised that they needed to be tough on crime to help prevent it. They were also keen to make sure that when a murder does occur, those who have been left behind in the aftermath are given support to begin healing. When a child is murdered, it leaves a hole in the heart that never really heals. While the parents of Ebony and other murder victims could not fix their own pain, grief or trauma, they could help other families going through the same trauma by offering a shoulder to cry on and an ear to listen. The Homicide Victim Support Group was the very first group in the world to be set up specifically for the families of murder victims. And while it's a club that nobody wants to join, today it has thousands of members. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. If you want more Morbidology and want to support this one-woman show, then head on over to Morbidology on Patreon or Himalaya Plus, where I have exclusive episodes and other goodies. The most recent exclusive episode was put up this morning. The support goes such a long way in helping Morbidology continue to grow. Can I also please ask that if you enjoy Morbidology, consider giving me a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, and if you're feeling super generous, leave a review. Big thanks to everybody who has simply listened to an episode as well. The support is very much appreciated. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, Still Unknown. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Hi, my name is Joe, and I want to tell you about my podcast that I host called Still Unknown, an unsolved true crime podcast. Every other Monday, I talk about a different unsolved murder, disappearance, or unexplained death in hopes that telling these stories will someday bring out the answers that these cases are desperately seeking. You can listen to Still Unknown wherever you are listening to this podcast here. And who knows, you may even be able to reveal the final pieces to help solve a case. So subscribe now to Still Unknown to hear a new case every other Monday. And let's try to solve some mysteries together.